Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Unfolding the Soul. Today we have Pastor Paul Vanderclay as a guest. He always talks about how he status people and how that changes the conversation. Not this one.
No status here.
No status here. He is come to explore his soul in the sorely needed to be discussed subject of service. So let's start with the first question. What is service?
Your well-being at my expense.
You want to expand that a bit?
When someone said service for this, I thought that's exactly right, because it's my parents very much lived lives of service. My grandparents lived lives of service. And so for me, service was a big, big part of the Christian faith. And so, and service is often putting the needs of others ahead of your own. And it gets really complicated because it's often putting the needs of others ahead of your own family's needs. And that then becomes a tension between, let's say, the pastor's family and the pastor's work. And that was, and I'd say that's been a big story for at least three generations in my family.
So it has to.
How
do...
juicy is that, huh? Did you think it wasn't going to get juicy?
Well, we're gonna get real juicy. So we're talking about a trade-off, and then the trade-off is between something that you're building for yourself and your close ones, and then I guess a sort of noblesse oblige, right? Like something that you can provide because you're put ahead of others in some sense, and that you want to give that back. So what would be the means by which you're of service,
giving money and giving time and attention, money, time, and attention. And if this really gets to say what the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul basically says, I wish you could live as I, where I don't have a family, because once you have a family, your service is divided, because you have you owe service to your spouse and your children and your parents, and you owe service to the Lord. And service to the Lord means basically service to everyone, often the least of these, often people who have endless amounts of need. And so, I mean, this is touched on in the Gospels. For three generations in my family, these have been issues, and figuring out the trade-offs and the balance between serving family and serving others, the least of these, it's a hard thing.
So when you're serving others, in some sense, it's like providing things to the whole world, like bringing some equality in the attention that people get. And obviously, because the world is so big, and it's even bigger now, because you have more access to more people, you got to be efficient. You got to be efficient in choosing who to serve and what way to serve. So do you have a way to deal with that?
There's no hard and fast rule. So for example, growing up, my father worked morning, afternoons, and evenings almost every day of the week. And that would be delivering food to people, helping people move when they had to move, going to court, visiting people in jail, visiting people in the hospital. And And so if, and in the minute, in my father's ministry, there was always someone in need. And so he would be there to meet it. Now, at some point you have to ask, when does helping hurt? And there's actually a book written by that title. When are you in your helping someone? Are you in fact, perpetuating a disability rather than some people could probably stand to be left with the need, which would probably perhaps force them into a confrontation with themselves that they need to, that they need to have. And those are really hard questions. And I've dealt with those kinds of questions a lot during my ministry. And I've probably responded to them in ways often different than my father did. My father, as he did this kind of work for 40 plus years, learned along the way. And as he aged, he found, he started making different decisions. And it's, and also the communal conversation has continued to change on this as well. So it's a big issue. It's a, it's, and you know, it's an issue that when I went to the Dominican Republic, I really had to deal with, because Patterson was one thing, Depression era Midwest, where my grandfather ministered, was one thing. And then the Dominican Republic was another thing, and the dynamics were totally different. And often in the Dominican Republic, because the, what a dollar could do in the Dominican Republic was so much more than what a dollar could do in Patterson. And my grandfather just didn't have any dollars. You would think that you could really help, because you could give a transformative amount of money to a poor Haitian, but there were many of them. You couldn't give a transformative amount of money to all of the Haitians. And then often what would happen is you would wind up, you would make the decision. Sometimes you would find a really sharp young man or young woman in the neighborhood, and you knew that with their level of character and diligence and intelligence, that if you could get them a, an American level education, they could have a dramatically different life. But then you also risk taking that person out of that community. And now the already impoverished community will not have that leadership resource that they would have had if you never intervened. Mm-hmm. These questions, just that so often there's no answer to them. And it's not like some theoretical no answer in middle-class America where you shrug your shoulder and say, we can't decide. When you're working with people who are living on that level, what you do or don't do will have a very observable outcome that will mean different things to different people. And sometimes it can mean life and death. I remember when there was a pastor who, he was old and he was in the hospital. And I was, the family, you know, that just kept paying hospital bills. And I went into the hospital and I talked to one of the doctors, and the doctors basically said, you know what we're doing for him, we bring him in here, and I don't exactly remember what they were doing, but basically we do these things on him, and then he lives for, you know, then he's good, better for another week or two, and then he's back in here. And I, so then at that one point, I just went to the family and said, I have this amount of money. You can spend it on his hospital bills, or you can spend it on his funeral, because I knew that when he died, they would need money for the funeral too, and all that's involved in a funeral. The rental of the, of the, you know, they rented grave burial places, the casket, and the food for the mourners. And this was a pastor, meaning, you know, there were going to be a lot of mourners because everybody would come in. And so I basically said to the family, I'm going to give you this amount of money. You can have it for the hospital, or you can have it for the funeral. And they decided they'd want it for the funeral. I said, okay. And so he died and gave it to him for the funeral. Now, did I have to draw the line at that amount of money? I didn't you know, it, I wasn't giving so much that my children wouldn't eat, but I remember a situation here in North America where a young man started a church plant in a very poor area of California, where there were a lot of immigrants and migrant workers. And I was working, I was part of the classical committee on, you know, on church planting. And then it came to my attention that he wasn't participating in the denominational pension system. And so I asked him, I said, why aren't you participating in the denominational pension system? Well, because my little church can't afford it. And I suggested to him that that was, he should make in their little church budget, they should make participating in that pension system a priority. And he just basically refused. So he didn't opt into the pension system. But, and that's easy to do when you're 27, 28. I also know that I've also known pastors who opted out of the pension system. And then when they became 65, 70, 75 years old, were destitute, and the churches that they were serving were then over a barrel, because now we've got this, we can't just sit here and watch him live in squalor. What are we going to do? And so all of these trade-offs with service, how much to give, when to give, how much time and attention. Attention is one of the biggest ones if you've got family and children. So these are the kinds of challenges that really, a lot of stuff, like it's arguing about stuff on the internet. It's arguing about stuff on the internet. Okay. But when you're dealing with these kinds of questions, that's hard for me.
Well, let's go to the start.
Like, okay.
When did you get a first idea of what service is, or like how did I get introduced into your life?
It was mapped onto me before I was conscious of it, because it was just watching my parents who'd watched their parents. That was how to live. That's what you did. It wasn't a conscious decision. It was just what you did. And so it's not till you're much later in life when you begin to see trade-offs that it's like, oh, this comes at a real cost. And it comes at a cost, because basically, if it came at a cost to me, that's fine. But if it came at a cost to others, now suddenly, wait a minute, service to others. Others include my wife and my children. Others also include anybody who knocks on this office door. So that happens later. And it usually happens when you're in a network where not everybody basically has the same assumption and level of service, or someone has, let's say, left the Christian faith because of a intergenerational service, and they look at it and they say, I spent my whole life giving for others, and I was the loser of that, and I'm no longer willing to give, and so you'd better prioritize me. And now suddenly, again, you're there in the middle.
Mm-hmm. So how does that work? So you're basically drenched in the service. So it's like whenever you can start walking, you start walking along, or is there like an initiation that you go?
Well, when I was a boy and my father was going, somebody in Patterson needed to move from one place to another, my father would have me come along, because especially once I got bigger, so I could start to carry things. And then I could help him move appliances. So I would just go with my father to help people. And I would see that the phone would ring in Patterson and I would pick it up. And, you know, it was people needing food. And I was always taking messages. We didn't have an answering machine back then. We had four answering machines, the wife and children of the pastor. And so we'd take messages. And then when someone would call and there was a need, off my father would go. If I was playing a game with him, or if he was even just sitting in the house reading, my father would go. We'd have vacations, and then someone would die. And then the father and mother discussing, do we cut the family vacation short and go back to Patterson to help this person? So it was always there as a kid. It wasn't out there as an issue. It was just always there.
And is there a transition where you consciously start pursuing it yourself?
Pursuing service or pursuing the conversation about service?
Was the conversation about service a thing that was present? Like not in the sense of should we do it, but like is this the thing we should be doing more so?
By the time myself and my sisters had left the home, I think it began to dawn on my father that he had missed out on something he wasn't getting back, which was his children. And you also begin to notice a pattern in ministers' children that some of them are bitter and resentful towards the church. And that doesn't really sort of come up until teenage and then college years. And you know, my father had to, he had to think about that. And he had to, but then it's too late. It's just regret. Because when you've got kids, they are in some ways so demanding that if you've got a demanding job and if you have children, you get whatever little me time you can get. But then, you know, the children are gone and you begin to realize those people are gone. And one of the things you do realize as a parent with children, that I have a little device here which has pictures of my children. I guess you can see it down there. Pictures of my children, and those little people and their little bodies, they are no more. And now, praise God, none of them have passed. They've all grown up, and so they've changed and flourished into young adults. But those little people are no more. And as much as we love them, as much as we enjoyed having them, they're gone. And so if you always made the choice to help anyone in need and opted for the strangers in need rather than your own children, well, you've made an exchange.
So do you feel like you've went the same path as your father? Like, did you see the same dynamic towards your children as you had to your father?
No. I probably prioritized my children more, maybe not as much as my wife would have had me do. Oh, it's a constant conversation with my wife because she winds up becoming the children's advocate because they can't advocate for themselves. But I think my ministry profile was a little different from my father's. I had temperamentally too. I've got more of my mother in me, and so I did have some lines that my father didn't have. I think there was only once that we interrupted a vacation for a funeral. But even that was only when my wife and I were on vacation, and we discussed that together, and so came to a mutual decision. But I think I balanced it better than my father. I don't know if I did it optimally, because you can go the other way and always prioritize your family too. That also comes at a cost.
So you're growing up. Is there a sense that like being in service is like estranging you from people in school, or like how does that interact with
no peers? not so much in school. In a church community, you know, you'll have a status hierarchy, and one way to gain status in a church community is to be exceptional in service. So
your school and your church were like highly bound, like the people?
Yes. I went to Christian schools tied to my church, K-12, and then to Calvin College, which is also tied to my church, and then the seminary, which is also tied to my church. So I lived within church school institutions all my life. In fact, thinking about my career then, yes, literally all my life.
And well, then the question comes, well, do you follow in your father's footsteps?
Yeah, and I did.
Yeah, you did. How did you make that decision? Like
that was a hard decision. I never really wanted to. My wife very much wanted to do mission work. And so I didn't do American inner city mission work like my father did. We went overseas, but then when we came back, this was a kind of work that was attractive to me and I knew how to do it. And my wife probably appreciated the dynamics between a pastor's wife and a church are different in more of a mission church like this one than they are in an established church. In an established church, some of the expectations on the pastor's wife tended to be a little bit more set. So, yeah, I wound up quite accidentally doing very similar work to my father after we left the mission field and found I really enjoyed it. I still enjoy it. And that's part of it too. It's not that service is unpleasant to do. Sometimes it is, but I have a lot of joy in helping people, especially mm-hmm. when you can really help them. That's really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always work out that way, but yeah.
So you go on the mission work before you have a sense of what you wanted to do. So is that like a year? Or like how long did you go there? Like
6 years.
6 years. So you just take 6 years of your life before you know what to do with your life?
I've never known what I wanted to do with my life. And so I didn't know I wanted to get a theological education until my fourth year at college, and then it's like, I think that would be fun, but I don't want to go and do the same work that my father did. That's what I decided. And then my wife's like, well, her parents were missionaries in Africa. So, and she was a Spanish major. So she's like, well, why don't we go somewhere in Latin America and live in Latin America? That'll be fun. So we go and live in Latin America, but you know, you think life's going to be a certain way and it never is. And then you begin to learn. And then you have children, and that totally upends your life. So as it wound out, my wife, who really wanted to do mission work, wound up taking care of our children. And me, who probably would have rather had more of a life of an academic, I'm out there working with people with almost no education. But I found that fun. I temperamentally, I'm a very sunny, happy person. And I'm pretty satisfied with most of what comes along. And so I like doing mission work. It was fun booning around the country, dealing with Haitian pastors, the adventure of living in another country, learning another language. That was all a lot of fun. Traveling, that was fun. It was all fun. And then I got to North America and I had two job offers, one for more of an established church in the Midwest, and the other for this one in Sacramento, and this one looked like more fun. And it was in some way similar to the church I grew up in. So everybody here at this church was surprised when dealing with the homeless and the people who were always looking for people who were destitute and high needs people. They were nervous at first. What's Paul going to do with these high needs people? And it's like, I've watched this is the ministry I've known my whole life long. So that's not that doesn't bother me. So I've enjoyed this.
So you come in this undeveloped nation and there's these certain needs. So how does that form your concept of service? Like does that change the way that you understand what you need to do?
I'm there for service, you know, and that's the whole gig. Now what sort of threw me off was I'm there for service, but I live as though, so in North America, my standard of living was always sort of lower middle class. We weren't hungry. We had food on the table. we didn't have nice clothes. We didn't have new cars. You know, televisions were always hand-me-downs. And I was very comfortable with that, because if you live a life of service, it's sort of life. It's not quite a vow of poverty, but you're not far from it. So good enough. And then you're working with poor people, and some of the church people in your church are quite a bit wealthier than you are, and some are poorer, but you're towards the bottom, and so no problem. And then you move overseas, and suddenly, first of all, you're able to get there, and you drive a car, and they're paying you on a pay on a wage scale that's commensurate to what you would get sort of at the bottom of a ministerial scale. And because life is weird and different things are asked of you, then, you know, you in many ways, you in a developing country, you live as though you're a very wealthy person. And that was strange to me, because I had never been a wealthy person, and I had never had to make decisions about myself as a wealthy person. Now, I wasn't wealthy in comparison to North Americans, but I was wealthy in comparison to the people I was working with. And then suddenly, okay, so the pastor's in the hospital and nobody has any money. And so I'm the only one they know with money. So they ask me, and what am I going to say? Okay, well, all right. And all the missionaries were in that, and the missionaries were finding different ways to try to help the people around them. But then you get into these dependency issues and all of these issues that I never would get into in North America, because I just didn't have that kind of money. Nobody looked to me for money, because they'd have as much or more money than I would. So it's not an issue. And so service, what does service mean when you're a wealthy North American living in the Caribbean? Oh, that's a whole new set of problems.
You're like a walking ATM in some sense.
And even here at the, you know, even here at my, sometimes I'll kid, because I'll say, you know, did someone tattoo ATM on my forehead? Because anybody knocks on that door and they, you know, the gas station's right across the street. And so they pull in there, they have no money for gas. They look up, there's two churches. Only one church has somebody sitting in it, which is this one. So they knock on the door. Are you a pastor? Yeah. I'm at the AMPM and I don't have any money for gas, and I live in Fresno. Can you fill up my tank? Okay. And, you know, filling up someone's tank, especially in past years, isn't going to kill me, but how many times can I do it?
So then you're talking about high needs people. So there's also a more emotional connection there, I assume, right? When there's someone who's actually dependent upon you in a highly personal way.
Well, you've got some people who are always calling and asking, and you've got other people who don't even let you know when they have a need that you could and would really love to help them. So you've got to navigate that dynamic too.
So how do you get that discernment? Because, like, is there like a social dynamic within the church that you're privy to? Like,
well, you make little rules for yourself sometimes, and then you also work with, let's say, so in the Christian Reformed Church, we have elders and deacons, and the elders tend to manage education, some of the education, evangelism, some supervision of the pastor, et cetera, et cetera. And the deacons tend to manage budget, diaconal needs, benevolence, these kinds of things. And so if you've got deacons, you can discuss issues with them. And you can also, you can always give money to the deacons, and then the deacons can make decisions. And it's also easier because if in the church you have an agreement that the deacons manage this, then it's not a matter of being buddies with the pastor so you can get help. You have to deal with that committee of your peers. And then there's a lot more accountability, and it's usually a better system. But that doesn't ever deal with it all the time. There's always issues that come up outside of it. And most of the homeless issues are
they come to me personally because the deacons aren't here all throughout the week and I am. So then I have to make decisions. And so like with one guy, he's always borrowing money. He always pays it back. So basically I have about $100 and I'll lend him money and up until about $100. And then I don't have any money because I don't carry money. And I'll just carry that amount of money that I know I'm willing to lend. And, you know, my father sort of worked out the same thing. My mother managed the money and she would never give my father money. If he needed $5 for a haircut, he had to ask her for $5. And which would sometimes really surprise people. It's like he never had any money. The reason he never had any money was that she knew if he had money, someone would ask him and he would give it away. And that was, and so then when he would like do pulpit supply, preach in another church because they were, and then they'd give him, you know, 40 or 50 bucks or something for preaching in that other church. Well, my mother would let him keep that money because that was extra money and he could give that away. So that's what would happen. So my parents worked it out that my father never had money, cash, because otherwise he would just give it away. And if he had managed the money of the house, then suddenly you'd have questions about getting the electric bill paid and food on the table. So she was like, I'll keep the money for the house. You know, we'll give money to the church. If you have extra money, you can give it away. If you need something, you ask me. That's how they worked it out.
Mm-hmm. So is that actually something you'd advocate, like segregating these responsibilities so that
yes.
people can, so there's a specialization that, yeah, just
requires you or
makes you effectively incapable of fulfilling certain other roles.
Yes. Yeah. And often I'll get requests and I'll say, you know, one of the things that's happened is churches no longer have local phones, which ours doesn't anymore because it used to be bundled with our internet service and we got fiber. And anyway, so because people would call and they would have a need and I would say, Pastor, I can't pay my rent this month. Okay. Come in on Sunday and talk to the deacons and you know, they'll make a decision. And more often than not, they wouldn't show up, which meant they found somebody else to give them money or they didn't need it or.
Oh, that's nice because that's like a filter as well. Yeah.
Right. And so then you get a sense of, you know, where is the need? And there was other people. There was a guy, there were a bunch of people. There was one guy who was basically living in a hotel and he was living in that hotel by getting money from churches. And he would just go down the phone book, calling the churches until someone would actually pick up a phone and then find somebody to pick up a phone who maybe would be in a position to help them. And this guy would say, oh, me and my mother just moved into town and we haven't gotten on welfare yet. And so we just need a little bit of help until then. And so then he'd call me and I'd go down and help him. And then he'd call me 2 months later and I'd recognize his voice. And I'd say, hey, wait a minute. Didn't I talk to you last month? Oh yeah. Okay. And then when the deacons were in charge, then the deacons finally made a rule that we're not going to help non-members more than once a year. So then the guy figured that because the deacons would tell him, no, you know, we helped you this year. We're not going to help you this year. Then the guy would put it on his calendar. And as soon as the year was up, he would call again. And the deacons are like, that's not the kind of service we're running here. And then he was all angry. He said, you said I could only help once a year. It's a year later. So, and it's like, is this an entitlement? So, and part of my father would never say such things to people. And that's where I've got half of me is my Frisian mother. You know what Frisians are. And so I would say things like that to people. And they kind of take a step back because they thought pastors aren't supposed to say that. But it's like, don't play games with me. I'm happy to help you, but the church isn't here to facilitate your particular lifestyle. We tend to help with emergency needs. This isn't an emergency need. And in the United States, I'm not going to say that the social safety net covers everything, but
almost all of the homeless that I deal with, I know how much money they get every month. I know what the deal is. And so it's like, and some of them are very open. They're like, hey, I've got a drug habit. I'm probably not too interested in financing your drug habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that sounds like a good example where the enabling aspect is really highly salient, right? So, like, what can you do for a person that's effectively self-destructive?
There was a guy named Billy who lived for a while. He was down here right by my office. I used to have kind of a string of people that live out here. And I eventually... I moved him because I knew some of the other guys. I knew that there was going to be violence if they were all there. So I told him he's going to have to move. And so we basically moved to the way far end of the corner. There's no shelter out there. He lived for 5 years in the corner of the property. And I'd go back there and I'd visit him sometime and say, you know, Billy, is this how you want to live? He came here. He got kicked out of his house because he was a meth addict, and his wife finally had enough and she kicked him out. And I'd help Billy out with this or that. And again, rule of thumb, you know, I'm much more, if someone has a need, I'm much more liable to give them food rather than cash, because about all you can do with the food is eat it. If you're hungry, you'll eat it. Cash, sometimes I'll help with cash, sometimes I won't. It all depends on my relationship with the people. So another rule of thumb is, develop a relationship with people. And so I'm much more likely to help someone that I have a relationship, because I have a better understanding of what kind of helping helps and what kind of helping hurts. And so I'm much more likely to not help a random panhandler than to help someone that I have a relationship with, because I have a much more confidence that maybe my help will go further towards a better situation for them. But he lived out there 5 years, and I knew that when we put the gates up, he'd be in trouble, because he's a 75-year-old man and he wasn't going to be able to climb the fence. And so I told him, I said, we're fencing in the property. You're going to have to go. And he went, you know, he didn't go until he saw that, oh yeah, I'm not going to be able to come and go here at all. And he left an enormous pile of stinking garbage back there, which we eventually were able to clean up and clean out. And there's no end to this stuff. Jesus says, the poor you will always have with you. Truer words were never said.
So, it's because we haven't gone into this, but there's a material aspect, a health aspect, and a spiritual aspect to the service. And obviously you, out of your function, want to lead into the spiritual. So do you distinguish between those dimensions? And like, how do you do that? Like, are you saying, if you're not making spiritual progress, then like, are you making conditionals?
No, like with my friend Daniel, with a lot of the people that I've known from the streets here, I don't know. It's not going to change. It's not going to change. They are, I've seen enough of them die. Like, just Gavin, who were watching the camera, watching the parking lot project, Gavin asked, well, can you see the homeless people with that camera? It's like, yeah, but not when there's all these construction workers here. And so then I looked down the road and there was a woman named Linda. And I've known Linda about as long as I've been here. So for about 25 years. And she used to sleep under the eaves with a guy named Larry. They were both drug addicts. Linda had lost her children. Her mother was raising her children, and Linda's been in the neighborhood a long time. And I just saw her with a shopping cart just a couple of minutes ago. And Larry, eventually, the guy that she was with, Larry, eventually, he was a veteran and he got some help from the VA, and he got,
I think to one degree or another, off the drugs and the alcohol, and he got inside and he eventually got a car and he did well for a while. And then he got sick and died. A lot of times what happens with these people is they'll something will happen. They might break a hip. I've known a number of homeless people who broke hips, falling out of trees, getting hit by cars. And then they wind up in a hospital, and then they're discharged from the hospital to a nursing home. And then they might just be in a nursing home until they die. Every now and then someone will be killed in a car accident or in street violence. And that's usually how most of them die. So I'd love to, like, again, with Daniel, I was just talking to him. He had 8 years of sobriety about a dozen years ago. Those are pretty good years for him, but he's in his middle 60s now. He's got Hep C. You know, he's going to die with this. He's never been able to really get his bipolar under control. His, you know, he'll come to me and I'll give him a ride to the psych hospital when he gets bad enough that he can't use alcohol, because alcohol for him is sort of the way he stabilizes his bipolar. But his esophagus is so bad because of years of drinking, he'll get to a point that he can't keep anything down, and then he just gets dehydrated. And so then I'll take him to the hospital and they'll flush his system, fill him full of vitamins and everything. And then he'll be able to eat and sleep again for a little while. And then he'll be in the hospital for a few weeks or a month. And then he'll get kind of bored and kind of miss the drugs and the lifestyle and get out again. And around we go again. He's going to do this until he dies. So in that sense, I sort of adopt a hospice posture with them. Some of these people have been in and out of rehab more times than you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Others, there was a woman at this church who, she was already here when I got here, and she came here. She was a schizophrenic, and the women of the church just sort of came around her and helped her sort of organize her life, and she had enough discipline and family support that she was never homeless the time that she was here. She came to church very regularly. You know, she always was a little odd, but everybody just accepted that from her. She was pleasant to be around. And then she, with her particular meds, sometimes, you know, basically what happened was sometimes her meds would make her sort of go stiff and she fell and she hit her head. She was alone in her apartment and she bled out. And that's how she died. And, you know, I that's a success story, because she was able to live for the last 20 years of her life a decent life with community and friends. So there's a success. But it's almost always the path. You learn that as a pastor alone, there's little you can do. If the whole community gets around someone, you can do more. But many, many people, they're going to die with their conditions.
So, yeah, my question was going to be in relation to organizing service, right? Because now you're leading a church, right? So you were saying that you were like delegating responsibility, but in some sense, people are also serving you, right? In order to serve the church. So like, what's that like?
Yeah, that's a good point. So part of the weird thing of my vocation is that I'm paid to serve. And so then I try to sort of specialize. I try to do the kind of service that most of the people in my church can't do. So some of that is pastoral. So my specific area of expertise, let's say, pray for people, do funeral services for people, do formal visits of people in the hospital, that kind of thing.
And sometimes it's be an example of service.
So hold on. So the pastoral part is more, I don't want spiritual support. I wanted to say emotional support, but that's kind of wrong, right? But it, would that be correct description, or are you also filling in a pragmatic guidance role there?
Both. So I'd say it's more specialized. So for example, doing a funeral, I can do a better funeral eulogy than anybody in my church, more than likely. I know the Bible better. I have theological training. I have experience doing liturgy. I've done lots of funerals. Most people, praise God, have only a limited number of funerals that they're responsible in their life. I participate in dozens of funerals. So I've got experience at things that most of the people in the church don't have experience. And so part of my job is they pay me to be that specialist. And so that's sort of the specialty thing. But sometimes it's also an example. So we're having a workday Saturday. Here's a great example again. Saturday's my usual day off. So, and Saturday's my day off because my wife is a school teacher. Saturday is her day off. And so Saturday makes the most sense to have our day off. Many people will get, let's say, a weekend away. My wife and I don't get weekends away. And so, except during the summer when she's off. So this Saturday, we're having a work day. It would be easy for me to say, I'm not going to be at the work day because Saturday's my day off. Yeah, but Saturday's the day off for just about everybody that's there too. And so I was at church Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then the Saturday after that, I have to help my daughter move. So you wind up, then it's like, well, why don't you take another day of the week off? Well, my wife is working. And so my wife wouldn't appreciate it. Say, honey, I'm gonna drive through beautiful Northern California today while you go to work. So I might as well work when she works, but you just wind up working all the time. And that's not a terribly good example to the people of the church either. So it's just all these balancings.
Can you give like an idea of what you spent your time at work?
Well, I know now I make videos. Before I made videos, I did reading and writing and visiting people and talking to homeless people and preparing sermons and fixing little things in the church and doing denominational things, doing, you know, all those kind of things.
So there's a level where you're like, you're fulfilling a duty because it's presenting itself, and then there's something above that, which is what you're called to do.
Right. So I'm called to prepare Sunday school classes and sermons and worship services and to be available to people to talk about whatever they want to talk about, to help with the other ministries of the church, to help people who are in need, and to educate myself and prepare myself to continue to be able to be theologically competent and also aware of, you know, the moral and social issues going on in the country. I mean, there's really no end to a pastor's scope of interest or responsibility. And then, of course, the whole YouTube thing came along. So which the church has very much encouraged and blessed, and partly because many people out there, you know, support the church financially now. And that's become, I got to be careful with those words because it makes it sound like Living Stones is this massively expensive ministry. The things that Living Stones cost Living Stones the most is my salary and keeping the building up.
Well, and the parking lot.
And the parking lot, that's right. I didn't think we'd ever see this. I frankly didn't think this would ever happen because it's, you know, our church budget is, $125,000 a year? It's our church budget. I mean, it's not nothing, but it's,
So, it's not a huge amount of money. So, the YouTube thing is something in which you're somewhat unique in the way that you're doing things. I think you're partially viewing that as well as a service to people. So yeah, how do you think about that? Like, how do you view that?
What's funny about the YouTube thing was that reading. I mean, until Jordan Peterson, I wasn't watching YouTube videos. YouTube was a place to see cats play. I didn't know that there were lectures out there. I was listening to podcasts. I was reading books. I was reading blogs. I mean, I was always reading and thinking. And then I was sort of blogging my thoughts, and I was discussing my thoughts on CRC Voices. And that was all part of sermon preparation and ministry preparation and doing denominational work. I was working on denominational committees and things. And so in many ways, the conversations are an extension of pastoral care and evangelism sometimes.
Well, hold on. I want to take a stop at the conversations, right? So there's part of the conversations that you publicize and part of them that you keep private.
Right.
And then there's, well, like some sort of ethical question around what are you serving, right? Like you see a lot of good in the sharing of these conversations because, like, you're proud of them in some way.
Yeah. That whole thing was just a surprise. So to comment on Jordan Peterson was sort of an extension of what I had done with blogging and writing on CRC Voices. I would see things and I would have to think them through, and I'd think them through out loud. So I make a Jordan Peterson video. Then suddenly people start sending me emails. So I start responding to the emails. And then people are like, well, can we Skype? And I thought, I talk to anybody who comes to my door. I suppose I can talk to anybody who comes through the internet to my computer. So then we start Skyping and Zooming. And then I began to notice, boy, I'm kind of repeating myself in a lot of these conversations. I wonder if I could sort of cut it off at the pass by having an example conversation and posting it on the internet. And so what
is the way in which you're repeating yourself? Because you're repeating yourself when you go outside as well, right?
Right. But on the internet, people are watching the channel and they have a question. And unlike when I get questions repeated to me on the street or in the church, I can record it and people can look up the answer instead of having me repeat it.
On the street as well. Like,
no, that wouldn't work. Someone comes up to me on the street and says, Pastor, blah, 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 blah. Wait a minute. And, you know, let me go through my smartphone. Here's my answer to this. Can I email this to you? I mean, the internet plus just the number, the scope of people via the internet. I mean, this is a small church, and there were a lot of times I did not get the kinds of questions I started getting on the internet. And I was getting way more emails than I was like, how much of my day can I sit here and respond to all of these emails? I'm cutting and pasting during emails too sometimes. Mm-hmm. Or I'm putting in links. And then when I'm talking to people on Skype, it's like, you know, recording a conversation. So then when I started posting conversations, then there's a new idea because people are like, well, I want to be on the channel having a conversation because people are watching each other and then they're meeting each other and a community is building. And then it's like, oh, okay. All right. Well, let's see where this goes. And it's just kept going.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. So you've followed John Vervaeke with Awakening from the Meaning Crisis. And I assume that partially because of the types of questions that you were getting in the conversations. Was that the thing that drew you to engaging there?
So as a pastor, you realize a few things. If you just sort of do biblical exegesis, people fall asleep and they don't remember it. If you just do abstract theology, people fall asleep and they don't remember it. If you tell a story, people remember. You learn very quickly that you can repeat the same abstract theological points week after week and nobody will complain. But if you repeat a sermon illustration, people will be like, you told us that story already. Oh, so you remember stories. Okay. So what you're always doing as a pastor is you're looking for stories. You're looking for illustrations that are examples of the abstract theological points that you want to make. Now, in ministry, you are surrounded by examples of those points you want to make, but you can't use them. You can't stand up in church and say, I'm going to preach about adultery. So yeah, you too. You know, you can't do that in a church.
Get up front.
That's right. So why did you step out on your wife? I mean, you can't do that in a church. But what the internet provided was, I can talk about adultery with Bill Clinton or Donald Trump or Hollywood stars because their adulteries are already out there in the open. So what the internet provides is a whole world of, you know, if you want to talk about, if you talk about atheists, everybody goes to sleep. If you talk about Sam Harris, a whole group of people stay awake because they know Sam Harris. So what the internet provides is an entire world full of illustrations where you're not just playing with abstract ideas, but you're talking about stories and living human beings. And that's way more interesting than people. So now suddenly, and you know, with John Vervaeke, so now suddenly we're not just talking about Sam Harris. We get to talk with a non-theist. And it's a lot harder to straw man someone you're talking with, because if you straw man him in front of him, he'll tell you. So the better way is to actually have good conversations back and forth. You'll have better conversations, and it's an improvement. And now we can not only do this, but we can share this. So I saw all of this as a tremendous ministry opportunity afforded to us by technology that was never available to me for most of my ministry before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about Telos in this little corner, and also in relation to the Telos of this little corner, right? So you're saying, well, there's this development, and now we have this thing. So when you're saying, I want to show this story, right? Like, why is it important for that story to be out there? Like, what's the telos in which your conversation with the atheist is participating in?
So if my main goal is to help people get a little closer to God, and now you can frame that in a lot of different ways, but let's just take that as my main goal. Having real conversations with real people is always better than canned stories. There are books and books of sermon illustrations because people knew that pastors needed sermon illustrations. And so, but it's just gross. Real things in real people's lives are almost always more impactful and transformative. And so, you know, you are a real person, and people who know you, they might disagree with you. They might be different from you. They might make different decisions from you, but there's a reality to you that they can't deny. And that's always more powerful in ministry.
Mm-hmm. So is there something that you're trying to draw out then? Like, is there a specific, because I'm looking for the direction, right? Like where, like when you're in a conversation, where's the conversation go?
I want to bring them closer to God. Now, that sounds very vague. And for every individual person, it might look different. It might, bringing them closer to God might mean they get to tell a story in a way that they've never been able to tell before, that brings a little bit of insight and transformation for them. It might mean that they get a little bit of healing or a little bit of truth or something of that nature. And
The image of God in them is restored just a little bit more today than it was yesterday. Because generally speaking, there are very few home runs. It happens sometimes, but there's usually lots of other stuff going on too. Most of the time, it's small incremental work. It's what I sometimes call word gardening. It's because a garden is a much better metaphor. I mean, all you can do that's fast in a garden is prune. yeah. A lot of the rest of the stuff is just slow. You do a little fertilizing. Maybe you cut away to give the plant a little bit more sun. But it's not unlike healing. So doctors don't, generally speaking, unless it's surgery, doctors don't heal people, but doctors help the body to heal. Pastors don't fix people. Pastors hopefully sort of put people in a place where they can draw closer to God.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now that's effectively what you're talking about is one-on-one pastoral care, right?
Yes.
But now you're also doing that with an audience.
Yes.
And the audience has different needs from the person in front of you.
Yes.
And so, like, how do you navigate that dynamic?
Well, I'm quite used to that because it's that same dynamic that I have in a church. Sometimes it's one-on-one in an office. Sometimes it's preaching or doing Bible study. So, and it's also in church, you relate to people in front of the church. And that teaches people how relationships are supposed to be in church. So there's, Nancy's going to watch this and she's going to tell Nina, Paul's been talking about you on the internet, and Nina's going to throw a little fit, but she can throw a fit if she wants to. So everybody at this church knows I have a relationship with Nina, knows I have a relationship with Nancy. My relationship with Nancy is very open because Nancy's often on the Freddie and Paul show. My relationship with Freddie is very open. But the main thing in church, so churches are delivery systems for sermons, for Bible studies, for helping with food or rent or groceries, or there are places where people can go to serve because service is a need of ours too. But churches are fundamentally networks of relationships, and people learn how to relate to one another by watching all the other relationships. And if there's a pattern of relationships, that pattern will get copied. And if you walk into a church and somebody stands up and starts screaming at their kid, everybody watches. Now, most of the time, we don't pay attention to that pattern of relationship, but we're always seeing it. So what I'm doing on my channel is hopefully, like as in church, giving some information, using illustrations, giving people something to think about, but hopefully also helping set a pattern of relationships for people to emulate.
Mm-hmm. So I've been talking with Mark a lot about second order effects. I think the whole Christianity is basically second order effects, right?
But like what's a second order effect? Can you give me an example?
Well, so I move my hand, right? And then the air moves as a consequence of me moving my hand, right? So, okay. So the first order effect is me having a direct relationship, right? It's my expression of my will, right? And as a consequence of me participating in a certain way in the world, other stuff happens. And so when I say something to you, right? Like I have an intention maybe in getting a response from you, right? But like I might also invite a dynamic between us, and that's like a second order effect of my question to you, right? So when you're talking about gardening, right? Like when you say, well, I let in more light, that's effectively relating to the world through second order effects. And I think Christianity is effectively, well, I look up at God, I fix my relationship to God, then I move through the world and everything will be provided to me, right? So like the whole world, you're living in second order effects. In some sense, you're incapable of having control, direct control over these. And at the point that you're trying to take control, you're corrupting them, right? So now going back to the church and the network of relationships, right? Like you got to deal with those relationships through second order and even some third order effects, right? Because like they might go through a whole dynamic. So I guess the question is, how do you deal with that, right? Like how do you navigate on that level?
Well, first of all, you can't control it. You never know what all is going to come from what you try to do. And there are always second and third order effects. You pay attention, and hopefully as you observe and learn from your observation, you develop wisdom. And over time, you learn. I like where you're going with this, because what I see often is people don't recognize these different orders of effects, and so they take the direct approach. So let's say
that's having mode, by the way.
Oh, okay. Okay. So they think, okay, well, pornography is a problem in the church. Let's tell everyone to stop doing porn. Okay. Go ahead, tell them. Well, I said it, but nobody listened, Pastor. So if you say it, people will listen. And first of all, you're like, I know that's not true. So, okay, don't do porn. And then maybe you discover that your admonition to not do porn has not resulted in any less, doing porn in the church. So then you begin to ask yourself, why are people doing porn? What's this about? Where does this go? What kinds of things do people need? Because actually the issue isn't porn as such necessarily. I'm not saying porn is good. I'm just saying it might be alcohol. It might be a whole range of things. And what you learn is that people are multivariant and enormously complex. And if you actually want to help someone do better, it's probably most of what you're going to have to help them with is going to be indirect. Mm-hmm. Every now and then the service can be direct, but most of the time you're probably going to spend a lot of time setting up a relationship so that someone will really trust you. And then once they really trust you, then maybe you'll be in a position to do something directly. But almost all the time is building that trust so that they know you're not going to hurt them. And then maybe you can help them. Maybe. So, no, you're exactly right. It's almost all second and third order. And what you learn then is to do things at a slant, in a sense. And this drives people crazy all the time, because people imagine it's all about direct. And people like to imagine that direct works. But if you watch people long enough, you realize there's a limited group of things where direct works. Most of the time, I want to help this over here, so I'm going to move this over here. Because I found when I help to do this over here, this gets better. I don't exactly know why, but I've seen the pattern. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of ministry is that.
Yeah, I want to add, right, because like when you're talking about addiction, like the addiction fills a hole, right? And like when you remove the addiction, you need to have something to take the place. And if you don't prepare to take the place thing, you can
like... You just have a new addiction.
Exactly. Or you fall back after a week or whatever. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, you're in real community. You learn very quickly that, yeah, the second order stuff is really important. Such as, for example, so one of the things that some churches major in is sort of, hard line accountability.
So there was a pastor in town who he was known because I'd hear from other people. And there's a lot of churches in this town, but this is a big church. Everyone was afraid of that pastor. And the pastor's main ministry tool was fear. You know what that meant?
Would you call people that fear of God, though? Or
no, it was fear of the pastor. He was going to call them out and, you know, all this stuff. Well, some people thrive under that. But for the most part, what people usually see you do is what they will do. So you set up this big chain of fear. The problem with that is then people would be telling me things like, yeah, I'd go to that church, but I haven't been for a long time. Why not? Oh, because, you know, if I go back, the pastor's going to yell at me. Oh, okay. So how's that pastor helping you live in the way that you know and think that and want and think you want to live when you're just avoiding the pastor because the only tool he uses is fear? And you see that all the time. And that's where... But you can't also just be, so then you have the opposite side, which is the therapeutic, which is like, oh, it's just all therapeutic. Well, that goes sour too. So it's all about learning when and where and how. That's wisdom. These are all the tools. Find out when and where and how each tool is best applied.
So I've personally found the demonic language, right? Like, really useful, because when you're like, well, when you're having this problem, right, when you're using the psychological language, is like, ah, like that's whatever. But like, do you want to be possessed by this, right? Do you want to let yourself be controlled by this, right? Like you're asking the pride, right, like to counteract, but it's a good first step, right? Because like usually what is lacking is the motivation, right? And the fear is the beginning of wisdom, right? Like, so like the motivation by realizing that it is a serious problem, right? And it's going to keep chasing you if you don't find the means to handle it, is important to get you moving, right? Like, you shouldn't get stuck in that dynamic, but it's a good way to bootstrap someone's action. So where am I going? So that's at least the way that I found, like, the spiritual aspect, right, like, is more real than whatever psychological framing you can provide, because you have a relationship to it, right? And they're like, it's coming from above, right? Like, and it's taking you over unless you find a means to resist that.
Yeah, the language is going to be contextual for different people too. And when you wind up dealing with a lot of different kinds of people, a big task is figure out which language group will probably be most efficacious towards the moving them closer to God. See, and even saying moving them closer to God, there's rooms that I wouldn't use that language, because
is that why you're scouring like the whole history for language? Or
and I'm listening. I'm very careful to listen to what kind of language has what kind of impacts where. And I also have a bias. Like, once someone starts, you know, starts going to church, and I'm less worried about them because they already have a pastor. But if they're not going to church, I tend to prioritize them because they don't. And so I just, you know, and so then sometimes people will be, I will sometimes have Christians get a little frustrated with me because they want me to do more Christian YouTube. And I say, there's already a lot of Christian YouTube. I don't find Christian YouTube very interesting. I find it much more interesting to talk to people who aren't going to church because they don't have a pastor. And so
maybe in a strange way, I'll sort of be their pastor through the internet. And even though I'm not really their pastor, because I don't really think you can have a, it's very difficult to have a pastoral relationship over the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, enough. No, I agree that there's this, yeah, like there's this group of people that have a need, and like they need to be catered to more so than the people who have a structure that caters to their need. So yep. Yeah, that's completely fair. So yeah, I usually try and get to a point where we're like, are we in the present of your life story? Like, are there gaps in the story that we've missed?
Was there no, I don't think so. In terms of service, I think we've pretty much covered the landscape.
Okay, so then I'm asking the aspirational question, right? So now we're going to go 5 years into the future. Everything that you want to do is working perfectly, ideally. So what do we see? Do we see you in 5 years having a new influx in your church? Are we seeing you muttering along on the paths that you're on? Or are you gonna like have a highly successful YouTube channel, or maybe you have like an idea of what like a structure that would be under you when you're having your YouTube channel that would support these people? Like, where do you see yourself?
I'd like the church to still be alive. I don't know that I want the church to be huge, because if the church is huge, then I don't know if I could do the YouTube stuff. If the church would grow quickly, then maybe I would hire someone locally to do, probably hire a young pastor and, you know, use that time to mentor the young pastor and get the pastor ready to take over for Living Stones when I retire in 7-8 years.
Is that something that you'd like to do, mentor someone?
I've mentored people all my life, so I would continue to do that. So yeah, I think if the church is going to live and have another major chapter, I think it would be, then I think we would hire someone to, let's say, be my replacement here. The one change that, and I don't know that I necessarily need my YouTube channel to be a lot bigger than it is. I think at this point right now, the YouTube channel is sort of, you know, even though the subscriber number grows, given the churn, it's probably staying, it's just growing slightly, actually. I watch that in terms of views and hours viewed. So the channel's at a good pace right now. I don't want it to get too big too fast.
So if we just set aside the church, right? Because like you're gonna do only YouTube. Like what is the thing that you would like to provide to the audience in your YouTube?
I think I'm already doing on YouTube what I want to do on YouTube. The thing I want to do more of is the thing that's just starting now. So we have the Chino event in May. I have an event in July. If the Israelis get that together, I might be in Europe in October. If the Israelis get their act together, I might be there in February. I would like to encourage groups of people to hold more in-person events, because I think that sort of fuels the network at a different level. That's the thing that over the next 5 years I'd like to see continue to develop.
Okay. Are you doing that as a guest speaker, or are you also trying to like have a supportive role in what you'd like to see on the ground?
I'm doing both. So I've had a heavier hand in organizing the Chino event, just because of my relationship with John Van Donk, and I sort of put him up to it. Cassidy is, you know, sort of leaning into the Europe stuff, although we'll see what happens when she has her baby. Eamon and Catherine are, you know, I think they'll do another Thunder Bay event. But I think at some point we're going to see more organization in terms of, let's say, Catherine and John Van Dunk and Cassidy and Hezzy and Sam. So Chicago's had their events. So I think we're going to see at some point more organization at the level of the people who are organizing events to learn from each other. And, you know, it was even before COVID, Sam said, you know, Pangburn screwed up and we should step in and, you know, do what Pangburn should have done. And I agree with that to a degree, except it's not going to be sort of atheist, new atheist stuff. It's going to be much more this little corner stuff. But Sam wanted to sort of go at that directly in terms of, let's start an organization. And I thought, no, the timing's not there yet. And so what we're seeing now is we're seeing bubble up from Cassidy and Catherine and John and Sam and Hezzy. And so we're seeing bubble up. And so once that gets to a certain level, because we don't know yet, or on Marcus, we don't know yet what the level of sustainability is going to be. We're going to see, like with Chino, how many tickets get sold. And we're going to learn from that. And so as we do this, we're going to begin to learn capacity and pacing. And so for me, in-person, face-to-face events are more important than YouTube videos.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say that this little corner is that you want to translate into face-to-face? Like what would be the essence?
I want people to have good conversation partners that they can continue to grow closer to God through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I get that answer, right? And then immediately all my alarm bells go ringing, right? It's because, like, what does that mean, right? And I think you've touched on this, right? Like you've said that, well, there's these people who don't have any education and like they're some of the best Christians I know, right? So what does it mean to grow closer to God, and how do you provide that to people?
Well, so again, as I said before, I hope everybody has a local church, and I hope everybody is participating faithfully in their local church. But I also know that in every local church, there are people like me and like you who you'll get your sermon, you'll get your preaching, you'll get your fellowship, you'll get your service, you'll get all service opportunities, you'll get all of that stuff. But then in church, there's always a few people who they read funny books. They're interested in different ideas. They want to have a conversation at a different level than they're likely going to find in their local church. And they find that level of conversation, that level of inquiry, that level of participation and community is not easily found in a corner church, even though they're getting a lot of their other needs met in that corner church. Well, this little corner is a place where hopefully they can be fed. And when they're fed, what they learn at that other level, they will be able to bring down into their local church as well.
Mm-hmm.
To the degree that it's needed.
So what's the food on the table and who's providing the buffet?
Well, you know, so right now, the video I released today was a video about Kierkegaard. In most local churches, there's really not a lot of point to bringing up Soren Kierkegaard. Because, you know, it's not germane to most of the people, but it is to some. How about Socrates? How about Plato? How about Jordan Peterson? How about John Verbeke? How about doing some next level thinking about this meaning crisis? And, you know, in some ways, you know, I do know that in the CRC, you asked about mentoring a little bit before. I've had a couple on my channel. This already started with my blog before, but through my YouTube channel, I continue to mentor young Christian Reformed pastors about how to think about the meaning crisis, how to think about secularization, how to think about evangelism. And I, in some ways, what I want this little corner to be is a really fruitful, helpful thing for not only members of local churches, but pastors of local churches.
Mm-hmm. So in some sense, you're an antenna reaching out of the institution, feeling how salty the sea is.
That's right.
So I guess that's a process that needs to happen, and the churches need to update, and they need fresh air, I guess, right? Spirit coming in. This is I guess one of the things that I personally run into, right? It's like, because I confession, I'm not reading Kierkegaard. I am actually drawing back from most of the intellectual stuff because I don't see it leading anywhere. And then the question is, well, like, okay, right, you found the fish in the sea. Like, how do you draw it in and chop it up into something that's actually a meal that can lead to somewhere? Because, like, I'm taking this idea of spiritual bypassing by John Vervaeke, like, really serious. And, like I'm not saying, like, you can't have a little spiritual exploration vacation thing. But, like, there's a rabbit hole, right? And you can get lost in the hole.
Yeah, it's true. Soren, use Kierkegaard. One of the things, so the video today was sort of about when you listen to Christopher Mastropietro and to a degree also John Andrew Sweeney talk about Christianity and why, and Christopher is going to Mass. John does not identify or worship in a Christian church. Andrew has more been exploring Buddhism, et cetera, et cetera. These are important things to learn from. And in some ways, Kierkegaard is a really interesting person sort of in that mix. And there's a reason why Christopher has sort of picked him out. And so Kierkegaard is sort of Christopher's Socrates. What Socrates is to John Vervaeke, Kierkegaard is to and if you look
so,
at
so I want to say one thing, because in the video, like, John Vervaeke said, like, we need Socrates Christianity or something, where he's like, well, we make, like, the more important part Socrates over the Christianity, like Socrates could subsume Christianity in some sense, and don't you see that as a corruption? Like, when you find that way in which you're not really in, but standing on the outside on the shoulders of someone else.
Jesus already conquered Socrates. I'm not worried when people try to go the other way around. Jesus totally. Ask Nietzsche. Jesus totally owned Plato. I mean, Jesus, the Christianity has been the best thing that's happened to Platonism ever. So I'm not worried. I'm not worried about Jesus' ability to colonize. He's the greatest colonizer that the human race has ever known. So when someone says something like that, I don't necessarily agree with it, but I don't feel the need to draw attention to it at that moment, partly because everything that you draw attention to, you at least to some degree or another give it some power. Whether you win or lose the argument, you give it more power. And so sometimes the best thing to do with certain ideas is to not give them attention.
Yeah. But, like, then we lose the sermon, right? So, like, there's...
I don't think we necessarily lose the sermon, because, I honestly believe Jesus fulfilled Socrates and Jesus fulfilled Plato. Now, that doesn't mean that Socrates and Plato go away, but I think Jesus fulfilled them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay. Let me rephrase it. Because, like, in my mind, it brings up idolatry, right? Uh-huh. So what is idolatry? Well, idolatry is effectively relating to the divine wrongly, right? Like, for example, having mode, right? You're trying to achieve through the first order effect the thing that you should achieve with second order effects. So when I hear these things, right, like I see people promoting idolatry. And I see idolatry as the primary modality within modern civilization, right? Because like it's in some sense the thing that you get born with, right? Like it's the mode of the flesh, and you have to learn how to step out of it and get a different relationship, one through fate. Because like if you don't have direct control, then well, you're going to have to relate to things in faith.
Human beings are almost all idolatry all the time. It's very seldom that we can move beyond idolatry. Now, there's obviously levels of idolatry, but for example, if you're going to point out and call out idolatry every time you see it, well, what are you going to do with the television? Because every single commercial is idolatrous. That's... You know, this car, this product is somehow going to make you transcendent. I mean, it's John Calvin noted the human mind is an idol factory. And so we have to deal with idolatry in different ways. And to always have to point it out or call it out whenever something strikes you as idolatrous, you would never get around to doing anything else but call out idolatry. So there's a time and a place for everything, and wisdom is knowing when to do what. And so, yeah, do I think Socrates... do I think you can substitute Socrates for Jesus? No. I thought C.S. Lewis put this very well. I mean, here's the thing about Jesus. Muhammad doesn't say he's the son of God. Socrates doesn't say he's, the culmination of the world. In some ways, part of the problem of lining up Jesus with Socrates and, you know, the Buddha or anything is, as C.S. Lewis pointed out, they all said very different things about each other. And at some point, you're going to have to deal with, Lewis, of course, famously put it in his trilemma. At some point, you're going to have to deal with the man who stood on top of a mountain at the end of the Gospel of Matthew and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." Buddha didn't say anything like that. Socrates didn't say anything like that. Muhammad didn't say anything like that. Confucius didn't. When people talk like that, we usually lock them up. Or we completely ignore them and ask them to move their shopping cart out of the way. Jesus said that, and yet he's continually on this list of great human beings. And so that's just a reality. And so, you know, I understand Jesus for better and worse. Leslie Newbegin said the church is the hermeneutic of the gospel. And when the church, as it does so often, does poorly, Jesus is not seen for who he really is. That's a perpetual issue in terms of the witness of the church. Yet Christ continues to work through his church. So I don't, you know, remember when the Taliban blew up those big Buddhas on the Silk Road because they were idols?
I remember that they blew up a whole bunch of things in Syria.
well, there's in Afghanistan, there are these enormous Buddha statues on the Silk Road that were, I don't know, 1,300 years old or something. And the Taliban blew him up. He goes, oh, there's idols, blow them up. Was that a good idea for the Taliban to do that? On just about any level? Probably not. And so I don't feel the need in a conversation to blow up. I don't feel the need in a conversation to act like the Taliban. Jesus, when you read how Jesus dealt with people, he can be very subtle and very crafty. And he tells us to do the same.
Yeah, that sounds like a good place to get to an end.
Well, good. You're going to let me share this on this channel at some point, won't you? This was great. Is this exclusive to Agapic Orientation?
No, if you want to put it on your channel, that's fine. I can share it with you. But I still want to ask you the question that I ask everybody when we've talked. And it's like, did you learn something about yourself during the conversation?
I did. I really did. You helped you, especially your last question about the next 5 years. I think you, and a couple other questions too. I think you kind of pushed me to clarify some things in some ways that I probably haven't articulated like I did today. So I thought this was really helpful. I really enjoyed this.
Okay. Well, and then I'm going to invite everybody to comment under this video, whether it's on my channel, Agapic Orientation, or on Paul's channel. And then Paul can get some feedback about what you got from him so that he can actually fine tune his stories so that he can provide the message that he needs to.
Awesome. Awesome. This has been awesome. I've loved this.
You've been a great guest. It's always good to circle around these things that aren't really talked about enough, right? Because they're in the background and like we need to shed light on these things, right? Like what are you doing during the day? Like what are these things that people need? Like how can we be involved in providing service? And what is it take off us, right? Like there's a cost to us and there's a spiritual growth that we can find in the service as well, which is also important for ourselves. So thank you a lot for being my guest, Paul, and I hope
thank you
everybody to see you again soon on my channel, Agapic Orientation.
Thank you for having me. I still have to look up your talk with Catherine and Father Eric. I'm looking forward to watching those. Maybe I'll make commentary on them.
Right.